Today is December the 23rd, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave me a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Windows 10 20H2 update reportedly damages solid-state devices' file systems if you run check disk. If you need to check the integrity of your solid-state device file system using the built-in check disk utility in Windows 10, be advised that some users are reporting issues with it when attaching the /F parameter, which tells the utility to fix errors on the disk. The problems seem to only be affecting solid-state drives, that's SSDs. The check disk utility, it dates back several decades and it was something we ran on many occasions. These days, Windows does a much better job of taking care of disk maintenance on its own. There are still instances when some savvy tech users might want to run the command, which is initiated by typing chkdsk in a command prompt, followed by any number of optional parameters. However, there are reports of the check disk utility corrupting the file system when run on a PC with a solid-state device installed in Windows 10 20H2. This is not an isolated case. This is also not due to the hardware. If installing Windows 10 64-bit and updating to 2020-12, then running the check disk C:\F command in a command prompt as an administrator, the system may hang with a blue screen and damage the file system. An automatic or manual repair is then required depending on how the system is set up in order to get the PC to boot properly again. Some users were able to run the command without issue, while others ran into the same problem. The blue screen error message appears to be related to, now get this, knowledge base that's KB4592438. I'll repeat that. Knowledge base KB4592438. Though Microsoft does not list this symptom as a known issue. In case you missed it, cable companies can no longer rent you the router you own. Is your internet service provider charging you every month for the cable modem or router that you purchased with your own money? Or perhaps have you never bothered to buy those items because you couldn't escape the fee? That fee became illegal this Sunday, December the 20th, and you should tell your ISP that you will no longer tolerate it. Last year, Congress passed a law that banned this as of June 20th, 2020. And though the FCC managed to extend the deadline 6 months by spinning the argument about how cable companies didn't have the resources to stop charging you money. I don't buy that, though, but that's what they said. The law, however, took full effect this past Sunday. Do note that the actual text of the law still allows some ISP to charge you, and that is if the ISP sends you a router, you'll need to return it to avoid charges, whether you use it or not. If you can purchase your own cable modem, I suggest you do so. Modems will generally pay for themselves in less than a year, and the all-in-one router boxes that ISPs typically provide typically offers worse Wi-Fi coverage than you could easily add to your house yourself, particularly now that mesh Wi-Fi systems are better, cheaper, and easier to use than ever before. Nikon says things are getting better for the company. 2020 has seen a lot of speculation that Nikon is in serious trouble, both due to its own internal issues and the ongoing pandemic consequences. However, in a recent interview, the company has said that things are looking up. Tetsuya Morimoto, Nikon's Europe's director, addressed some recent questions regarding the company and its future, in particular regarding 2020. Morimoto acknowledged that the company was hit hard by the pandemic and the subsequent drop in consumer demand, but said that they have seen a better rebound than initially anticipated. Nikon has fallen on hard times as of late, as its camera sales have cratered, and now there's a new indicator of how dire its financial situation is. The company is reportedly pulling the plug on making cameras in Japan after over 70 years of manufacture in Japan. The Japanese newspaper Asahi reports that Nikon is pulling the plug on its Japanese camera factory and moving camera production entirely to Thailand in order to cut costs. Asahi reports Nikon had been operating two camera factories, one in northern Japan and one in Thailand. Nikon has already moved production of its Z6 and Z7 mirrorless cameras to its Thai factory, and now the company will be moving manufacturing of its D6 DSLR to Thailand by the end of 2021 as well, as it ends the made-in-Japan era of Nikon products. Nikon's Sendai factory in northern Japan opened in 1971 and has served as the company's mothership manufacturing plant for nearly half a century, advising the technical operations of factories outside of Japan. The factory was damaged in the massive earthquake that struck Japan back in 2011. The company's Thailand factory was established in 1990 and has become Nikon's main factory for producing cameras and interchangeable lens over the past 30 years. In a statement to Asahi, Nikon states that while camera production will be transferred out of Japan, its Sendai plant will continue product parts for video products as well as serving as an incubator for new businesses that will support Nikon's future. When the operating system you have been using is no longer supported, or the upgrades for the system requires more resources that is just not cost-justified, what do you do with the old system? I have accumulated quite a number of old systems that's been sitting around that, well, I just have that emotional feeling about throwing it out because it did cost quite a bit of money and it really is usable. And I would like to just give it away, but I want to put an operating system on it that someone can make use of the machine. In the past, we have been recommending downloading one of the many Linux distros to run on the systems that you no longer need. Now there's another choice. I've been tinkering around with Neverware. It's a startup with Chrome OS variant that squeezes extra life out of the old Windows PCs and Macs. Now under the radar, Google has quietly bought Neverware, a company that created a variant of Chrome OS called CloudReady, which turns old Windows PCs into Chrome OS machines. CloudReady could be the perfect answer for those continuing to stick with, say, Windows 7 PCs, despite Microsoft having stopped delivering free patches since January the 15th. Importantly, CloudReady still gets patches and fixes just like Chrome OS, served up every 6 weeks. You may find it more suited for the average user who doesn't want to venture into Linux land. CloudReady is typically offered to schools to breathe life into old PCs with G Suite for education. The devices are managed via the Google Admin Console, but businesses and individuals can use it too. Old Macs can also run CloudReady. The home edition is free, does not integrate with Google Admin Console, and lacks technical support. The education subscription costs $20 a year per device with 1 year of technical support, while the enterprise option costs $49 per year per device. The paid-for options include 1 year of technical support. Neverware and CloudReady are joining Google and the Chrome OS team. Neverware said in a statement that there are no changes to Neverware's existing prices. As CloudReady becomes an official Chrome OS offering, you can expect to release mechanics to fall in line with official Chrome OS releases. Neverware was founded in 2011 and launched CloudReady in 2015. Google invested in a Series B around 2017. The company says it has 1.37 million in stores. There are two notable catches with switching to CloudReady, though. After installing it, there's no returning to Windows, so users should make a backup of their files. Also, after transitioning, accessing a local drive becomes difficult because this Chrome OS variant relies almost entirely on Google Drive for storage. SSD prices set to drop in the first quarter of next year due to oversupply of 3D NAND. Client and server SSDs are expected to get cheaper next quarter. As leading makers increase their 3D NAND bit output, prices of flash memory drop due to oversupply. This leads to sinking prices for solid-state drives. TrendForce predict that the next quarter prices of client and server SSDs will drop by another 10 to 15% compared to the fourth quarter of 2020. Traditionally, PC makers decrease production of computers in the first quarter due to seasonal downturn. As a result, demand for components such as memory and SSDs drop and their prices drop too. Prices of enterprise SSDs to drop also. The analysts expect that as competition on the enterprise SSD market intensifies in the first quarter next year, prices of appropriate products will decrease by 10 to 15%. TrendForce believes that due to dropping demand for everything towards the end of the first quarter of next year, prices of mobile storage devices will drop by 5 to 10%. Publisher apps for Android Auto can now test in closed testing tracks in the Google Play Store. Most smartphones have full GPS capability on board, so navigation is a natural thing to use it for. All that is needed to get going is an app that handles the mapping and navigation. There are many options for all smartphone platforms. Smartphone car navigation isn't a premium product like the old days of paying something like $3,500 and upwards for the navigation package with a touchscreen. The trend now is to use a smartphone for car navigation. Advantages of the smartphone over the built-in navigation for the car includes traffic reports, in-route traffic reports, and the ability to reroute should an accident be in your way is invaluable. The maps are up to date, since smartphones use maps stored on the remote server. The maps used are always as current as can be. And you can also have easy destination entry. Smartphone apps allow sending addresses to the phone for use in navigation. Integration with a contact database is also possible. Smartphones make it easy to turn looking up a contact address into a trip with navigation. And automakers understand this, so majority of the car makers are not wasting time and they are offering and not charging to have smartphone navigation. Once the smartphone is connected and while driving, users have access to all the vitals like maps for directions, making calls by accessing the contact list, listen to music stored on the device, and send and receive messages. Automakers realize if you can't beat them, join them, so the apps that they've developed are supported in Android Auto and iOS CarPlay. Both Android and iOS have apps for car navigation. According to Google, over 500 car models support Android Auto, and on the Apple website, there are more than 500 car models that support iOS CarPlay. The 500 models supported by each, however, do not overlap 100%. There are some model cars that support one but not the other. An example is the current model of the Toyota Camry. It has support for only the Apple iOS CarPlay at this time, but you buy a car that matches your driving needs and not a car that matches the smartphone you use. By the way, keep in mind that some automakers charge additional fees for the feature or leave you with no choice but to get an upper trim or certain model for you to unlock this feature. Fortunately, if you have an older car that does not connect to the smartphone, you don't have to buy a new car to take advantage of Android Auto or iOS CarPlay, but it's going to cost you both money and time for the conversion. There are plenty of aftermarket head units available, hovering around $400, going all the way up to $1,000 and beyond. At present, these systems are using Google Maps and Waze, but this will change. Android Auto for smartphones is a helpful system for any car driver, and it reduces the distraction when interacting with navigation, music playback, or phone calls when you're driving a car. But Android Auto had one big problem. The platform came with a series of limitations that prevented third-party developers from bringing their apps in the car, thus forcing users to stick with the likes of Google Maps and Waze. This is changing, though, as Google is opening up Android Auto to more categories of apps, including navigation, parking, and charging apps. After launching the Android for Car apps library in beta in October, Google is bringing an avalanche of new apps to Android Auto. And starting this past week, developers can publish apps to a closed testing track in the Google Play Store, which means they can now get better feedback before the public launch. Google created a closed testing release to test pre-release versions of the app with a wider set of testers to gather more targeted feedback. Once they have tested with a smaller group of colleagues or trusted users, they can then expand their test to an open release. In other words, with today's update, developers can run beta tests for their apps right from the Google Play Store and thus control the entire program more effectively before launching open testing pretty much anyone to download the app. While Google is making a big change in an attempt to bring more developers to Android Auto up to this point, only a few confirm such projects. Sygic, S-Y-G-I-C, is one of the first to take advantage of this update, as their navigation app is already in the beta stage with support for Android Auto. Times are changing, and we no longer have to pay a premium price for in-car navigation that requires an update once a year at a certain cost. Almost every mobile device you own has some type of built-in storage. From cameras to iPods to tablets, and almost every device has a slot for adding additional storage space. Storage on a device can range from a couple of gigabytes of memory to dozens of gigabytes. Flash memory cards have published speed class marking specifications for the data transfer speeds, whereas USB flash memory from the same manufacturer with the same model will vary with speed from one unit to the next. The very first flash memory card format was the compact flash, also known as the CF card. Compact flash used to be the standard. The substantial weight and bulk of CF cards made them tougher and more resilient, and you will find CF cards that have higher temperature resistance. But all things change, and today, the Compact Flash Association backs XQD cards as the official replacement for compact flash cards. As such, the speed of compact flash cards have been stagnant for some time, and while they still are very fast cards, they aren't the fastest around anymore. CF cards and XQD cards are still competing for dominance in the post-compact flash card world. UDMA-7 compact flash cards are the fastest and have maximum read speeds of 167 megabytes. UDMA-7 has been around for a while, which isn't the case with the fastest SD cards. The UDMA rating determines the maximum bus speed at which cards can read, assuming the memory in the card is fast enough to match it. UDMA supports speeds of up to 16.7 megabytes per second. UDMA 7 is 10 times that speed, maxing out at 167 megabytes per second. This is the minimum sustained write speed, the slowest the card will write. Capacity of CF cards range from 2 gigabytes to 512 gigabytes. You won't be misplacing these chunky memory cards easily. Next in the flash memory card arena are SD cards. SD stands for Secure Digital, and these cards quickly rose to the top of the memory heap due to their high capacities and improved speeds. In the beginning, however, a standard SD card could only handle a capacity of 128 megabytes to 2 gigabytes. Standard SD cards are a rare breed these days, as the industry have moved on to SDHC and SDXC. The file format SD cards was FAT16 originally. They can be used in any device that has an SD card slot. SDHC cards use a different file system, FAT32, which can handle capacities between 4 gigabytes and 32 gigabytes. SDXC cards use XFAT and support capacities between 64 gigabytes and 2 terabytes, though 2 terabyte cards aren't on the market yet. Hardware-wise, there's no difference between SDHC and SDXC. However, older SDHC card readers that aren't able to understand the newer XFAT file format won't read SDXC cards. SDXC compatible card readers will always be backwards compatible with SDHC and normal SD card readers. Traditionally, SD cards were always a few steps behind compact flash cards when it came to performance. But compact flash cards haven't been updated in a while, and SD cards have recently passed them with UHS-II cards. UHS-II SD cards offer read speeds up to 312 megabytes per second, almost twice the speed of UDMA-7 compact flash cards. Micro SD cards are essentially just miniaturized versions of full-size SD cards and share all the same classification like their full-size brethren. There are now micro SDHC and micro SDXC cards. SD cards are easier to lose, especially micro SD cards. SD cards have a unique physical lock on the front of the card that prevents accidental erasure of its contents. SD cards have class designation indicating speed. The faster the card, the faster it can save a file. Speed class is a minimum speed based on worst-case scenario test. SD cards range up to 2 gigabytes. SDHC cards range from 2 gigabytes to 32 gigabytes, and SDXC cards range from 32 gigabytes to 2 terabytes. The speed class rating for these cards measure maximum transfer speed for reading and writing images to and from a memory card, expressed as megabytes per second. Unlike card read speeds that measure maximum performance, class rating measure the minimum sustained speed. Class 2 cards are designed for a minimum sustained transfer rate of 2 megabytes per second, while Class 10 cards are designed for a minimum sustained transfer rate of 10 megabytes per second. The speed class rating is an older speed class rating. Many consumer products still recommend products based on the old standard. A Class 10 is the fastest of the old speed class rating, and a Class 10 card is verified to never write slower than 10 megabytes per second. Class 4 would never be slower than 4 megabytes per second. Now there are even UHS-II and micro SD cards, and they have the same speed class ratings. However, due to their small size, they typically are a little slower and available in lower capacities than the top-of-the-line full-size SD cards. UHS speed class ratings. This is a minimum sustained writing speed of the card, important for video recording. UHS speed class 3 cards will never write slower than 30 megabytes per second. In other words, each number represents 10. UHS speed class 1 cards never slower than 10 megabytes per second. UHS speed card 3 never slower than 30 bytes per second, assuming the memory in the card is fast enough to match it. Both the card reader and card must support the same standard to benefit from the increased speed, but UHS cards are backwards compatible with older readers, just they won't be as fast in them. UHS speed class was introduced in 2009 by the SD Association and is designed for SDHC and SDXC memory cards. UHS utilizes a new data bus that will not work in non-UHS host devices. If you use a UHS memory card in a non-UHS host, it will default to the standard data bus and use the speed class rating. Instead of the UHS speed class rating, UHS memory cards will have a fuller, higher potential of recording a real-time broadcast, capturing large-size HD videos and extremely high-quality professional HD. Video class speed, or V-class, was created by the SD Association to identify cards that handle higher video resolution and recording feature. This speed class guarantees minimum sustained performance for recording video. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Working in the Same Household.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for us to get down to business, and actually a lot more of how it applies to us throughout our entire lives. And in this case, I want to talk a little bit about this experience we're going through. This is something that in our lifetimes, most of us have no concept whatsoever what's going on. Yes, we've still been going through this for many months now, but we're also looking at a future where we're going to be going through this for a long time. What is it? Yes, staying at home, working from home, classes from home, all kinds of different people in the same square footage that we've had before, whether it's 1,000 square feet or 1,500 or 2,500. It doesn't matter. Whatever space you have for your home, everybody is there. So how do we work together? How do we establish in a home what's going on? We've already seen, of course, the computer sales go through the roof because, yes, everybody has to have their own computer for them to access Zoom or WebEx or whatever it is that they're utilizing for work or for schooling or for whatever. Okay, so we've already had that boost. But one of the things that a lot of people keep talking about in circles where I'm going through and I'm talking to people, they're like, how do you handle it? Okay, in my case right now, my wife is still working out a transition to, I moved halfway across the country and she's going to be following me. But how do we work with this? Well, one of the things that we're all going to have to do is we're going to have to find individual spots within the home for us to work. And maybe you've already done this. It does not do well for us as parents to oversee every moment of what our kids are doing. That's going to bring us away from work. It's really not going to help them become self-sufficient and so forth and so on. So what I want you to do is I want you to find ways to separate everybody as best you can. Now, we also all have to learn our indoor voices. We all have to learn how to be quiet. We can't be yelling at our boss or our subordinates. We can't encourage our kids to be maladjusted. We have to show them what temperance is about, tempering our own behavior and our own demeanor. So let's talk about this. What are the things that we can do to make sure all of this works? Well, for starters, if everybody has their own room, even if that room happens to be the dining room for one person and a living room for another person and a bedroom and the master bedroom and all of that, that's fine. You spread people out. But the other thing I also want you to do is make sure that all the doors are open. Now, for years, we've said, okay, dad's gone off into the study and he's working in there and he's closed the door and he's isolated. I don't want anybody isolated. I don't want anybody hiding away. Why? Because that's not how we should be dealing with life. We should not be hiding away from our problems. We should be dealing with our issues, all of the different things that we're struggling with. If we're struggling with the volume of the kids, we need to work with the kids, not tell them to be quiet, but work with them to reduce their volume and to increase their levels of respect. And I know this is something that we've all been trying to deal with. But hopefully some of the words I'm saying are a little bit different than how you've been approaching this. So isolation is not good. And yet we're doing a mild form of distancing. See, there's a difference. Isolation means you're all by yourself. Distancing means somebody's nearby. And the office, if you're in the office, these days you know, you'd be in a cube farm, right? So you've got all kinds of different people around you. And yes, some of them have to learn their indoor voices. Let's train our children these days to have indoor voices. And let's also not stress out. Let's also not worry about it. Okay, yes, we are all aware. I get a kick. I have this meeting that I go to on a daily basis. It's on a WebEx, and I just sit there and I listen to one of the people who's a part of the meeting, and I hear his kids in the background, and he stresses about it. I'm like, no, don't stress out about it. We are all in various situations right now. I think those kids are adorable. I have not met them in person because he's many miles away. And I haven't met them, but I think it's just, I can hear the laughter in their voices and they're having fun. Why would you squash their fun? They're giggling, they're laughing, and you know what? Life is too short right now. We can't be all serious. We can't be all nose to the grindstone and just isolate ourselves away. We need to embrace and work with what we have. And we control the things we can control, and we give up on the things that we can't control. You're not going to be able to stop a toddler from giggling or laughing or screaming in terror or whatever it is. And you're not going to be able to do that to the dog either. Just be flexible. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. You may not realize it, but most of us have some degree of mission-critical work on the personal computer. The latest trend is to place most, if not all, of our data files into the cloud. Google's global outage last week should cause us to rethink of what alternatives are available when your primary vendor has a massive outage. Google made a change in authentication, which was connected to all their applications. Instead of initial restrictive testing to a small group or regional part of the country, they implemented the change globally. We may not know the details of the operation, but there did not appear to be an alternate backup system readily available to get everyone back up and running immediately. Storing your data with a big tech firm does not guarantee you'll always have access to your data when you want it. Caveat emptor. Google suffers global outage with Gmail, YouTube, and a majority of services affected. Cause was due to lack of storage space and authentication tools, causing system to crash. Google says the global authentication system outage on Monday was caused by a bug in the automated quota management system impacting the Google User ID service. This worldwide system failure prevented users from logging into their accounts and authenticate to all cloud services. As a direct result, users weren't able to access Gmail, YouTube, Google Drive, Google Maps, Google Calendar, and several other Google services for almost an hour on Monday, December the 14th. During the outage, users could not send emails via Gmail, mobile apps, or receive email via POP3 for desktop clients, while YouTube visitors were seeing error messages. On Monday the 14th of December, from 3:46 a.m. to 4:33 a.m. Pacific Time, credential issuance and account metadata lookups for all data user accounts failed. Google explained that as a result, they could not verify that user requests were authenticated on virtually all authenticated traffic. The majority of authenticated services experienced similar control plane impact. Elevated error rates across all Google Cloud Platform and Google Workspace APIs and consoles. The root result behind the outage was decreased capacity for Google's central identity management and system due to a bug impacting the automated quota management system. This led to issues verifying that Google user requests were authenticated, resulting in errors being displayed on all authentication attempts. Google uses an evolving suite of automation tools to manage the quota of various resources allocated for services. Although safety checks are set in place to prevent unplanned quota changes, they weren't able to properly react to the scenario of zero reported loads single service. Google said that this major outage also affected the company's internal users and tools, causing delays during the outage investigation and the reporting of status updates. Gmail, affected by a second outage, happened within a single day. Gmail was affected by a second outage for a combined total of roughly 7 hours after the authentication issues were resolved on Monday an outage that affected a subset of Gmail users who experience email delivery issues. As a result, the service incorrectly transformed lookups of certain email addresses ending in @gmail.com into non-existent email addresses when the Gmail user account service of these non-existent email addresses, the service could not detect a valid user. That failure caused tools that do not work without logging in, such as Gmail and Google Calendar, to be unavailable entirely. Third-party services that uses Google's authentication platform continue to be accessible for users who already logged in, but failed when users tried to sign in or out of the service. Services such as YouTube failed entirely for users who were already signed into a Google account, but could be accessed in a private browsing mode in order to view the sign-out version of the site, which continued to work. The outage severely disrupted services for many workplaces. Google Suite, one of the services affected, manages not only email communication, but also intra-office messaging through the chat and meet services and actual work through Google Docs, Sheets, and Slides. Even those who use other services experience problems. Some workers relying on Slack, for instance, the Salesforce-owned chat app, could only talk to colleagues who were already logged in at the time of the outage, unless they had set up a username and password on Slack itself. For those working from home, the outage affected Google's smart home services, including the Google Home smart speakers and the Nest thermostats and smoke alarms. While they operate in fail-safe mode, users cannot access the services through an app to change the settings. The widespread failures caused many to highlight the risk of digital concentration where an outage at a single company takes down a substantial portion of the online activity. People sat in the dark unable to turn on their lights controlled by Google Home. Our dependency on technology has grown so much that the amount spent on reliability, testing, and quality hasn't grown in parallel. Many companies will be reviewing their agreements with Google, realizing their business is dependent on a stack completely outside of their control. The Google outage follows a significant failure at Amazon in late November, and there the company's Virginia data center failed for almost 90 minutes, taking down not only Amazon itself for most American users, but also many other services and websites that rely on Amazon Web Services. Companies, including the file sharing site Flickr, the podcasting service Anchor, the streaming service Roku, and the logistics business ShipTee were affected by their outage. So too were a number of smart home services while they waited for the work to come back online. The widespread failure by Google services revealed to many the extent to which they rely on the company for basic tasks. The company's smart home services were some of the first to cause real problems. Users who had rebuilt their homes around voice commands found themselves unable to turn on the lights thanks to a failure of Google Home and Google Assistant, while those with the company's Nest thermostats were unable to control their home's heating with an app as they had become used to doing. Also lost were the security cameras sold by Nest, which rely on Google's servers to stream footage to users' phones. The outage may have been concerning for those fearing a poorly timed home inversion, but was more alarming still for the many parents who have adopted Nest indoor security cameras as a smart baby monitor. The service's features, including Wi-Fi video streaming and motion detection, are perfect for use as a monitor when the system is working, but failed when Google servers went down. School children were marginally less upset to learn of the outage. Google's classroom service, which ties together the company's products for schools, failed along with everything else, leading at least one Michigan school to clear a 21st century equivalent of a snow day, giving the pupils a day off once they had missed the window for getting everyone online at once. Google said, "Please rest assured that systems reliability is a top priority at Google, and they are making continuous improvements to make their systems better." Reports from around the world that multiple Google servers have gone down, Gmail, YouTube, Google Drive, Google Docs, Maps, AdWords, and AdSense, Google Pay, Google Home, Nest, and Google's Chromecast are all experiencing outages with dozens, even hundreds of reports so far coming in from across Europe, the United States, Canada, India, South Africa, countries in Central and South America, and Australia, and likely more. Mainly, though, it's an unprecedented failure, for Cisne has grown to be one of the biggest traffic and activity drivers on the Internet, with billions of users across Google's different properties. Well, Google has explained what happened. I want to hear what Google is going to do about it. To make the systems so that not everything breaks down when one item breaks down. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. It's a gift. Well, It's a Gift was supposed to run last week, and Last Week Report's Snow Belts was supposed to run this week. Don't worry, Marty. This mix-up was only a senior moment caused by climate change.
Uh-oh, my fault. Hey, this was supposed to run last week, but I had a senior moment. And I don't mean the kind that involves co-eds. Tonight's report is called It's a Gift. It's about some of the coolest stuff that's been through here for review. Things that don't fit other categories. Seven of them. And you'll still hear about those after all. There are some gifts that still get given after the holidays, especially the gifts that others haven't given us. But before it's over, we'll also share a minute after the last minute idea for gifts that may still be able to arrive before the reindeer. Here, in the chronological order in which their reviews appeared, are my Magnificent Seven. The Yoohoo Air Quality Sensor keeps tabs on indoor air quality. Its wonderfully high-tech sensors monitor temperature, humidity, air pressure, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, ozone, nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, and airborne chemicals, including VOCs, volatile organic compounds, you know, things with fumes. Bottom line, the Wi-Fi connected Yoohoo indoor air quality sensor gives current readings, historical charts, push alerts for worrisome readings, and advice on what to do about them, all while sitting there looking like it isn't doing anything at all. EndoSnake micro video cameras are next. Imagine you want to capture video of how a keyboard works, shot from underneath the keycap. You'd need a camera the size of a matchstick on a snaky gooseneck. We got in three USB-connected EndoSnake cameras that can do that in resolutions up to HD, and each with a dimmable LED micro headlight ring surrounding its tiny lens. These little cameras snag unique views inside working items. Bottom line, EndoSnake video cameras go where few other cameras can fit, and their smartphone compatibility means they're fully prepared for snagging fascinatingly interesting footage anywhere you can get one to reach. Next, the Works 20-volt cordless compact vacuum looks more like a double-deep Tots lunchbox than any vacuum you've ever seen, but it handles small jobs that would be clumsy for bigger vacuums to address. It's self-contained, from its stretchable hose to its telescoping crevice tool and a clever double brush attachment. A standard 20-volt Works tool battery is good for 20 minutes on its lower speed, 10 minutes on high. Bottom line, the Work 20-volt cordless compact vacuum tidies up monitor frames, keyboards, mice, phones, and other dusty little things where full-size vacuums are just plain awkward. The Weatherflow Tempest outdoor weather station got upgraded. Its solar power now comes from a surround array of vertical solar panels that are more efficient with any angle of the sun and work regardless of cloudiness. It measures wind speed with ultrasonics. Yes, that makes it Doppler. With 0.1 tenth, okay, tenth of a mile per hour resolution. Its wind direction resolution is 1 degree. Measuring rainfall uses haptics, now with multiple piezo sensors for improved sensitivity. It also measures temperature, air pressure, humidity, solar brightness, and UV brightness. There are no moving parts. Bottom line, the new Tempest from Weatherflow is the most advanced, least temperamental, most learning-aware, most integratable, highest-tech weather station that any consumer could ever dream of getting. No electronics in this next one. DiGiorno Croissant Crust 3-Meat Pizza from Nestle and Stouffer has sausage, pepperoni, and beef atop cheese and sauce on a really wonderful croissant-like square crust. It takes longer than many frozen pizzas, 26 to 28 minutes at 400 degrees, and then a 5-minute rest, but the wait is worth it. Its inspired croissant crust has a flavor and texture that are all its own and easy to detect in any bite, but especially striking when you bite past the toppings and toward the oven-raised edge of the crust. Bottom line, see if the new DiGiorno croissant crust pizzas don't earn a place among your top three favorite frozen pizzas. Next up, we installed the extremely impressive Honeywell Prestige IAQ, indoor air quality, IAQ thermostat kit from Resideo. It wirelessly links its main display and control unit, you know, the one you expect to see, to a gateway, an equipment interface module, an outdoor sensor, an indoor sensor, and two duct sensors. It can automate and orchestrate our complete central HVAC system, the fan, the gas furnace, the air conditioner, humidifier, dehumidifier, and the dehumidifier's fresh air intake blower. If you want schedules, do them. Ditto for handset control. Over time, it learns how long it takes the house to adapt to scheduled setting changes and uses that to backtime such transitions. It'll be where you want it when you want it there. Bottom line, a Honeywell Prestige IAQ kit intelligently automates six HVAC elements, keeps an eye on everything, and provides a level of control that makes it all look easy. And finally, Remudio 2, a tidy little USB-powered pod, 2 inches by 2 inches by 3/4 inch. It connects to Bluetooth, optionally can also connect to Wi-Fi, optionally connects to the internet, and can also connect to your garage door opener. When you drive away, get out of Bluetooth range, it handles closing the door and automatically opens that door again when you get close enough to home for Bluetooth to connect. You can also add a manual open button in the garage, open with the app, or add it to Alexa or Google Assistant, or touch the big button on its app. Bottom line, attention to connection security while automating garage doors or electric gates makes the desirability of Remudio 2 an open and shut case. Those are the seven. Now, let's put an end to your panic. You have a whole other day to buy the rest of those presents and get them delivered, and hundreds of ways you can still get that done. Among those hundreds of ways, well, almost all of them are gift cards you can buy online and get delivered by email. Amazon is the poster child for that, but if you know where your favorite people shop, check with those websites and see if you can't do the same thing there. But absolutely no to the idea of leaving home to shop in the stores. Every kind of store is going to see an invasion of frenzied shoppers. And no matter what your neighborhood is, no matter how much you're willing to risk the crowds with full faith in your mask and hand sanitizer, there's simply no safe way to do that. If you listened to last week's Out of Order segment, you know that next week's segment is Turning 21, about changes we can expect when we finally flip off the calendar past 2020. And when you get to 2021, here's some of what you can expect from these reports. On January 6th, if UVC is invisible, why is there a gold rush? On January 13th, getting water out of its shell. On January 20th, coronavirus ineffective tech hall of shame. On January 27th, enjoying the cam on the dash when there isn't a crash. Until then, we all wish you the happiest of holidays, no matter which ones or how many you celebrate. And the same for your family, who won't mind not seeing you this year if it means you'll be alive to be with them next year. Have faith that we're exiting dark ages for an era of peace, prosperity, and progress. Season's greetings to all of you from your very seasoned crew. This year, we'll take that cocoa to go.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. New York Amateur Computer Club. Speech recognition presentation, Thursday, January the 14th, 2021 at 7 p.m. Via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The following computer clubs haven't finalized their meeting time because of the pandemic and the holiday period. These are their websites that you can go to check when they have scheduled their next meeting. Princeton PC Users Group, ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group, limac.org, that's limac.org. Westchester PC Users Group, wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that is the acgnj.org. And finally, Computer Learning Center at Ewing, they closed up in March and they haven't restarted yet, and they're waiting for the ending of the pandemic to resume meetings, but their website is clcewing.org. That's clcewing.org. That's a computer learning center at Ewing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of this program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week. You only got one or two more shopping days left. Merry Christmas.